and I enjoy sharing with you some of my what I've learned over the years about dispensationalism. I did a little study for this because I was asked to spend some time on the history of dispensationalism, and that was something I knew something about, but really not enough to lecture on. So this past summer, I did a good bit of reading. I think history is fascinating, and it's helpful to know something about the history of these things. I know I was raised in a little country church in eastern Arkansas. It's in what they call the Missionary Baptist. They're called the Missionary Baptist because they split off from the Southern Baptist in 1905 when the Southern Baptists formed their mission board. And I really agree with the Missionary Baptist on this. Their position was and is that you shouldn't do your mission work through a quasi-autonomous church board. It should be done through the church and through committees. And that's why they call themselves Missionary Baptists. But they do believe in landmark Baptist theology, the teaching of J.R. Graves, which developed in the Southern Baptist Convention. And that's the teaching that the Baptist Church is the only church on earth. And if you're not in the Baptist Church, you can be a Christian, you can go to heaven, but you're not a part of the church, and your preacher's not a preacher. He's just somebody that lectures to you every Sunday. And you may get a little water sprinkled on you. You may get dunked into the water, but you're not being baptized because it wasn't done with Baptist hands. And you may take a little fruit of the vine and eat a little bread, but that's not the Lord's Supper because it wasn't done at a Baptist church. But anyway, that's what I was raised with. They believe that to be a true church, you have to teach New Testament doctrine, Baptist doctrine, and you have to be able to trace your water baptism back to John the Baptist. And they do that through these splinter groups in the Middle Ages and early churches, which if you study closely, a lot of them were heretical groups, but they think they were Baptist churches. But anyway, that's what I was raised. But being raised, I was taught, you know, the premillennialism, the pre-trib rapture, and things like that. Although it wasn't lectured, it wasn't emphasized a lot, but that's the only view on prophecy that they taught. And I can remember when I was a teenager when my father bought a Scofield Reference Bible. I think that's the first one I'd ever seen. And I remember my father telling me, you know, there's a lot of good stuff in this, but not everything in there is true. Because, you know, it wasn't all Baptist teaching. But I can remember at college when I first began doubting the pre-trib rapture doctrine. And, you know, when you're raised like this, you have a doctrine like that, and you just are totally unaware that it's a fairly modern doctrine. And the way you've been taught growing up, you just assume that it's on the level with the virgin birth of Christ, the bodily resurrection of Christ. And to begin to question a doctrine like that, it's a difficult thing. And it just surprises you when you learn, well, this is a fairly recent doctrine in the history of doctrine. And really, when you learn that, it really helps you in your perspective. And you learn that, well, you're not rejecting Orthodox Christianity because Christians were around for centuries and nobody heard of such a teaching. Well, I had a long little introduction there. My only point on that is it's helpful to know the history of these things. Well, what I want to talk about this morning is the history of dispensationalism. I want to go back to its English origins and just cover this up through its early influence in America. And I want to begin by looking at the premillennial movement that started before dispensationalism started. As you probably know, not all premillennialists are dispensationalists, but all dispensationalists are premillennialists. And let me just give you a little quick background about premillennialism, and then I'll go to the prophetic landscape in England in the 19th century, which the 19th century being 1801 to 1900. There were some premillennialists in the early church. Now what a lot of people have heard and what I was taught at Dallas is that was the predominant position in the early church, but it really wasn't. It was a minority view. I learned this. A man I knew at Dallas Seminary, he was... It took me 5 years to go through their four-year program, and he graduated the same year I was supposed to. He started a year later, but his name was Alan Patrick Boyd, and Alan was unusual. He was from Canada, but he just did better with the languages than maybe anybody else there at Dallas when I was there. It's very unusual. I was in a Hebrew class at Dallas, and just out of the blue, the Hebrew professor stopped and was just telling us he had never had a student like Alan before who picked up on the languages so quickly and was doing so well. Now, the funny thing about it is, at Dallas, in their THM program, you had to have a major. And Alan's major wasn't Hebrew or Greek. It was church history. But for his thesis requirement, Alan was reading in the original Greek all the church fathers up through Justin Martyr, and his purpose was to validate a statement by Dr. Charles Ryrie, who was a professor at Dallas back when I was there, that you've probably heard of, the Ryrie Study Bible and that sort of thing. Dr. Ryrie, in one of his writings, had made the statement that premillennialism, and he meant by that dispensational premillennialism, is the historic faith of the church, meaning that that's what was the predominant view of prophecy in the early church, and that the church had fallen away from that. And so Alan wrote his thesis. I used to have a copy, but I gave my copy to the seminary down there in the other Jackson, Mississippi, RTS. But Alan, in his thesis, came to the conclusion that many of the men that are listed in these lists of early premillennialists, there's no evidence that they were premillennial. And the few that were, their premillennialism was radically different from dispensational premillennialism. But Alan, he wanted to graduate, so he was careful to say in his thesis that he himself was a dispensationalist, and he just viewed his findings as evidence that the early church had departed from the truth quickly and radically. Because there's no record. I mean, there's no record. Although there were a few premillennialists, their viewpoint was very different from dispensational premillennialism. So there were a few premillennialists in the early church, and then when you get with Saint Augustine, who was so influential, and his view, as you probably know, was that the millennium is not some future thing. It refers to the church age, and of course, some people in the Middle Ages viewed it as an early period of the church age, or maybe the entire church age. Some the church age perhaps beginning with Constantine, when Christianity kind of conquered the Roman Empire. But anyway, in the Middle Ages, premillennialism just wasn't an issue. Now, the Middle Ages, there wasn't much premillennialism. Now, dispensationalism starts in the 19th century. And at the beginning of the 19th century, there were premillennialists, but English premillennialists at that time was at a very low ebb. What was dominant at the time is what we call historicist postmillennialism. That was the dominant view in England in the 19th century. Now, you're probably aware of the difference between premillennialism, postmillennialism, and amillennialism. Just in case you're not, I'll just give a real simple, short explanation. These all have to do with your understanding of the relationship of the second advent, the return of Christ, to the millennium. Not necessarily talking about the 1,000 years it mentions in Revelation 20, but the millennium as a historical era of gospel prosperity and dominion, cultural dominion on earth. And if you're post-millennial, it means that you believe the second coming of Christ will be after such a period occurs in history. Post meaning after. If you're premillennial, you believe that Christ will come before such a period occurs. And basically, if you're premillennial, often, maybe even normally, a part of your conviction is that you cannot dominate the world spiritually through the preaching of the gospel and the power of the Holy Spirit. That you can, through the preaching of the gospel, you can win individuals to Christ, but you can't conquer the world. And so the only way that this period of prosperity or gospel dominion can come in is it has to be a change in the ball, in the rules of the game. Christ has to come and he has to impose the gospel upon the world as a lifestyle and worldview through political coercion, you know, ruling with the rod of iron. And so since you can't bring in the millennium, the period of gospel dominance, cultural dominance, the nations being discipled through the preaching of the Holy Spirit, and since they do believe it will occur, they think it has to happen after Christ is here, and he does it through force instead of through the preaching of the gospel. And of course, pre means before, so Christ will return before there can be or will be such a period. And amillennialism means that there never will be such a period of dominance. The gospel will never dominate in that sense within history. Now, you have those three defined viewpoints. Now, like I said, at the time of the early 19th century, 1801 and following, historicist post-millennialism was what was dominant among English evangelicals. Not post-millennialism in the more defined view, as these views became more defined, but in its earlier incipient form. Now, it was historicist post-millennialism. Now, what we tend to be familiar with is what we call futurism. Dispensationalists are futurists, but in their view of prophecy, but most non-dispensationalists today are as well. You tend to be either a historicist, a futurist, an idealist, or a preterite, and I guess I should mention the cyclic view. And these are all different views of where you think the tribulation period that's talked about in the book of Revelation fits into history as a prophetic fulfillment. A futurist is somebody who thinks this prophesied tribulation period will be just before the end of this age, just before, right before Christ returns. Like I said, and the man of sin, the Antichrist, is somebody who will not arise in history until just a few years before Christ returns. Like I said, all dispensationalists are futurists, like they're all dispensationalists are premillennialists, but not all futurists are dispensationalists. As a matter of fact, that's the kind of dominant view of prophecy among evangelicals today. The axiomatic view or idealistic view is that the tribulation prophecies aren't directly referring to any period in history, but they just refer to some principles that are true throughout church history. And of course, whichever view you had, you should accept the axiomatic principle that there is always throughout the age tribulation for Christians, and there are principles and lessons we can learn from the book of Revelation in dealing with that. The preterite view is the view that the tribulation period, the man of sin, the Antichrist, refers primarily to the experience of the early church, the persecution under the persecution in Jerusalem before 70 AD, and then the persecution after the Romans, under the Romans, starting with the Nero's persecution about AD 66. If you study Calvin's commentary on Daniel, you'll see that in his commentary on Daniel, he has a preterite view there. About the best known preterite is B.B. Warfield. If you want to read some on that, you know, read B.B. Warfield's articles on the man of sin. He has some articles on prophecy that are really good. And that's my own understanding, is that a lot of these prophecies do refer to the experience of the early church. The cyclic view is the view of William Hendrickson, the well-known Dutch commentator. It's kind of a combination of the preterist and the futurist. And he believes the book of Revelation has a series of cycles, and each one starts out with the early church experience and then goes to end time experience. And so some verses he'll interpret like a preterist, and some he'll interpret like a futurist. And he sees a series of cycles of these, you know, little pericopes in Scripture that are going from early persecution to end time persecution. But anyway, the historicist viewpoint is the viewpoint that the tribulation refers to the entire church age, and the man of sin is the Roman church papacy, the Pope. So that's what historicist is referring to. And that was the dominant view at the time. Historicist postmillennialism was the dominant view among the English evangelicals in the early 19th century. And that had been their view for some time back. Now, back in the 17th century, that would be 1601 through 1700, the English Puritans had a postmillennial optimism about the church age. And as I've said, postmillennialists are optimists about the long-term success of the power of the preaching of the gospel and the power of the Holy Spirit. And they believe that the gospel has the power to deliver not only individuals, but also entire cultures and peoples and nations. And postmillennialists believe that the nations will be discipled in this age with the glorious fulfillment of the Great Commission, and that the result of this will be the ushering in of a golden age of peace and prosperity before the second coming of Christ. According to Peter Toon, T-O-O-N, we can translate this optimism, this post-millennial optimism, all the way back to John Calvin and Geneva. Now, let me backtrack just a little bit. We're familiar with the 1640s. That's the time of the middle of the Puritan century, and that's the time when the Westminster Confession was written, the Long Parliament, the Westminster Assembly, and all of that. Now, in the 1640s, there was a revival of premillennialism among English Puritans. I got this here a little bit out of chronological order. I've already told you that the early church, there were a few premillennialists. After St. Augustine of Hippo, premillennialism was pretty much lost and forgotten. But in the 1640s, there was a revival of premillennialism among English Puritans. One of the men who revived this, who wasn't English, he was from the continent, his experience was he had seen his people go through the 30 Years' War, which was a war for when the Catholics were, Romanists were trying to take back over lost territory. A 30 Years' War, where the period where he was decimated. And you tend to have people beginning to believe in premillennialism when they are pessimistic and have trouble believing that the gospel is going to prevail. And so they think, well, the only way, they still believe that the gospel will prevail, but they begin to have loose faith that it can be done through the preaching of the gospel. And some of these early premillennialists, some of them just believe that Christ would return, the martyrs, and maybe some others would be resurrected, and Christ would overcome all this terrible opposition, set up his kingdom, and then he'd go back to heaven and continue for the rest of the millennium ruling at the right hand of God the Father. It's not like the premillennialism that's taught today, but there was a revival of this, something relatively new since the early church. I mean, some of the Anabaptists were premillennialists, but it just wasn't. It was a very, very minority opinion. It had little place in Protestantism, and then there was this revival in the 1640s. And a minority of the Westminster divines adopted this view in a moderate form. There were a few at the time that adopted premillennialism in a radical form. They were called the Fifth Monarchist. And you may guess where they get that title. It comes from the book of Daniel, where you have the four world empires, that are metaphorically set forth in a couple of ways in the book of Daniel: the Babylonian, the Medo-Persian, the Greek, the Roman, that's four. And then, of course, the fifth is the one not represented by a beast or a portion of Nebuchadnezzar's statue. It's the Son of Man, or the stone made without hand that topples the statue. That's the fifth kingdom. And so they were believers in the fifth kingdom and were looking for Christ to return. They were an extreme and radical form of premillennialism. Well, what was radical about it was they thought, through political intrigue, through military effort and things like this, that they could hasten the return of Christ. So there were some extreme premillennialists at the time. We're talking here the 17th century, the time of the Westminster Confession. Now, in all its forms, 17th century premillennialism was a short-lived phenomenon with no lasting influence of any real significance. According to Ian Murray, premillennialism, it's hard to get that out, quote, practically disappeared from the mainstream of evangelical thought in the century which followed, which of course would be the 18th century, 1701 through 1800. Now, at the beginning of the 18th century, 1701 to 1800, the church in both Britain and America was overcome with worldliness and indifference. You know, you had this great spiritual revival, the Protestant Reformation. It kind of reached a high point in the 17th century with Reformed Orthodoxy and the Westminster Assembly, the Westminster Confession. Many would think it's the highest expression of Reformation theology that you found. And then with the failure of the Presbyterianism in England and Oliver Cromwell, and then the restoration of the monarchy, there came a period of worldliness, and the church was in weakness again. This both in Britain and America, the 18th century, the early 18th century, around 18. And then, to the surprise of many, there were, by the grace of God, the Great Awakening in America and the Wesleyan Revival in England. Now, these revivals transformed society, and they confirmed and strengthened this Puritan hope for the bringing in of the millennium through the preaching of the gospel. A real example of this transformation is in 1793, the recently formed Baptist Missionary Society in England sent William Carey to India as the beginning of the modern missionary movement. Now, by the time Carey died in 1834, there were 13 British mission societies that had formed with a vision to reach the world for Christ. Now, the earliest leaders of the modern missionary movement were strongly motivated by their optimistic belief that prophecy would be fulfilled through the discipling of the nations before the return of Christ. Now, I think I call this the early 18th century. This is the early 19th century. Again, in the early 19th century, very few English Christians were premillennial, and most of them were, again, still historicist post-millennialism. Now, as I've already said, the historicist position very commonly identified the papacy as the Antichrist. And a lot of people, they aren't aware of this. This view that the papacy was the Antichrist, which was in the original Westminster Confession, it's not in the American version, this was an identification that was practically universal among Protestants for about three centuries, 300 years after the Protestant Reformation. And as I've said, the historicist view regarded the tribulation prophecies in the book of Revelation as a history of the church age up to the millennium that was written beforehand in apocalyptic symbols. Just to give you a flavor of the historistic viewpoint of the tribulation found in the book of Revelation, Take, for example, the vision of that invading horde that numbers literally two myriads of myriads, or 200 million as some translate it, found in the latter half of Revelation chapter 9. If you're a historicist, you would probably interpret that as the threat to Christian Europe from the Muslims, which would have been the Turkish Empire. Or if you take the beast rising up out of the sea that you find in Revelation chapter 13, and you were a historicist, post-millennialism, you would probably interpret that. The beast rising up out of the sea would be a prophecy of the rise of the power of the papacy in church history. Now, the historicists, post-millennialists, basically viewed the current history of their day as some particular stage in the tribulation that's described in the books of Daniel and Revelation. Matter of fact, in some of the writing of this period, people will identify the vial of wrath that they think is being pointed out while at that particular point in history as they understand it. Now, historicists also, trying to give you a flavor of how this predominant view differed from the premillennialism that came and also from the dispensational premillennialism that arose later, they often use the day-year theory in their interpretation of Daniel and Revelation. And you may have been exposed to this a little bit, because where you see it in our own culture is the Adventists, the Seventh-day Adventists, still use this view of prophecy. This theory, the day-year theory of prophecy, was based on Ezekiel chapter 4, verse 6, where God commanded Ezekiel to lay on his side for 40 days, with each day representing a year in the history of the nation of Judah. And that may be based on Numbers chapter 14, verse 34, where God judged Israel with 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, that being 1 year for each day that the 12 spies had spied out the land. So they use these as an indication that when, in prophecy, when God said something would last so many days, they interpreted each day as referring to a year. And the rabbis before had applied this theory to their interpretation of the book of Daniel, and some Protestants applied it to both the books of Daniel and the book of both Daniel and Revelation. And this sort of prophetic interpretation was very common among the English Puritans. According to this theory, for example, the 42 months of Revelation chapter 13, verse 5, that was 42 months, a period of 1,260 days. That wouldn't refer to 1,260 days. It would be a symbol for 1,260 years. Or the 2,300 days of Daniel chapter 8, verse 14, would represent not 2,300 days, but 2,300 years. Well, I've tried to define historicist postmillennialism, which was the predominant view of that day, and we need to then look at the reasons for the revival of premillennialism in the early 19th century. You know, this had never been a predominant view, just a minority view in the early church, almost unknown in the Middle Ages, wasn't accepted by the Protestant reformers, maybe some Anabaptists accepted it. A minority view during the time of the Westminster Confession. Then it revives a bit in the 19th century. Why did it revive then? Well, around the beginning of the 19th century, this is the early 1800s, a series of events occurred which caused many to fear that the world was falling apart. And that's when it's in times like that that premillennialism tends to rise, when people lose their faith that the world can be conquered through the preaching of the gospel. Now, there was first the French Revolution, and then there was the French Reign of Terror, and then there was the rise of Napoleon, and then the Napoleonic Wars. And because of this political turmoil in Europe, some became pessimistic about the possibility of transforming the world through the preaching of the gospel. And instead of concluding that the age of gospel victory must be just a little further down the road because it couldn't come during this time of great turmoil. Instead of thinking that, some of them began to believe that the millennium could be ushered in only after Jesus returned to this earth bodily and began reigning from earth with a rod of iron. I mean, somebody had to deal with Napoleon and people like that. In the words of Ernest Sandin, there was a, quote, a kind of failure of nerve. So these early 19th century English premillennialists were basically all pessimists about prophetic fulfillment. And they generally all believed that the gospel could save individuals, but not society. And they were thinking that things would just get worse and worse and worse until the return of Christ. Now, that sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it? But this is a few hundred years ago. And so there was in the early 19th century a modest revival of premillennialism. And this premillennial minority came to believe that the next major event on the prophetic calendar was not the millennium. That's what the historicist postmillennialist believed. That was what had been the common view and what was still the common view. The next major prophetic event on the calendar would be not the return of Christ, but the golden age. Well, these people began to believe, no, the next prophetic event is not the golden age. It has to be the second coming of Christ. And then the golden age will come in after that. Now, as historicists, these early premillennialists did not believe in an any moment return of Christ. That's what a lot of people believe today. Christ could return at any moment. But because these were historicists, they had to believe that the second coming couldn't be at any moment, but they believed it would be soon, but not at any moment. It would be in the not too distant future. Because, you see, they were historicists, so they believed that there were certain events that had to happen before Jesus Christ could return. Now, here's why they thought the returning was real soon at that time. In 1798, the French general Louis Berthier, this is a French word, I'm guessing at the pronunciation, I've never taken French. It's a Berthier. I'm pronouncing it Berthier. He occupied Rome, established a republic, and exiled the Pope. Well, you know, there were prophecies about the fall of the Antichrist. The Pope was exiled from Rome for a period. Well, with unusual unanimity, the historicist premillennialists of that day interpreted that specific historical event as a fulfillment of a prophecy found both in Daniel 7 and Revelation 13. Now, this is key. Here's an event in history, and almost everyone among the premillennialists of the day agreed this is a fulfillment of prophecy. So they had a key, kind of like a Rosetta Stone, to tag in a date to the fulfillment of prophecy. I'm not agreeing with these people, but this is what happened. Revelation 13:5 says the beast was given authority to continue for 42 months. Now, using the day-age theory, you see they're interpreting the exile of the Pope from Rome as the end of the 42 months. He no longer has authority. Using the day-year theory, in which 42 months stands for 1,260 years, and identifying the papacy as the beast of Revelation 13, these historicist premillennialists identified the year 1798 as the end of the 1,260-year rule of the beast. Now, with this confident correlation of the year 1798 with Daniel 7 and Revelation 13, the historicist premillennialists were certain that the second coming was then imminent. Real soon. To use the terminology popularized by Hal Lindsey, they believed that they were living in the terminal generation. Now, most of these early 19th century premillennialists also believed that the Jews would return to the land of Palestine before the millennium. There was a man named John Way, And he's credited as the one most directly responsible for the renewal of interest in the Jewish people among the early 19th century premillennialists. And they were concerned both with Jewish evangelism and with the cause of Jewish resettlement in the land of Palestine. Now, let me get off a little bit on the sides. Some people think that dispensationalists are the only ones who've ever had this idea that there'd be a future conversion of the Jews and that the Jewish nation would be reestablished. But that's not true. There were these early premillennialists, before there ever was such a thing as dispensationalism, had this vision and this hope. But they weren't the first people to have this idea. It goes all the way back to some of the early Protestant reformers. In the 16th century, which of course would be the early 1500s, Martin Bucer, Peter Martyr, and Theodore Beza, who was Calvin's successor at Geneva, all believed that the Bible teaches a future calling of the Jewish people to Christ. In Romans chapter 11, Paul said that all Israel will be saved. And later editions of the Geneva Bible, such as the 1599 edition, had a note on Romans 11 stating that the Old Testament predicted the future conversion of the Jews as a nation to Christ. And in the 17th century, the 1600s, this was a common expectation among English Puritans, you know, a few years and years and years before there was such a thing as dispensationalism and before this Puritan, this small premillennial revival. Now, not all Puritan interpreters expected a Jewish revival, a Jewish conversion to Christianity. And not all Puritan interpreters who expected a Jewish revival, not all of them expected a Jewish restoration to the land of Palestine. And now, those who did, among the Puritans, who did expect this, a revival among the Jewish people and a restoration to the land of Palestine, they did believe these things long before the dispensationalists. But they differed from what dispensationalists would later teach. Here are the ways they differed. They held that the converted Jews will become a part of the Christian church. They weren't talking about a return in a tribulation period to an Old Testament system. They believed that when there was a national conversion, the Jews would be brought into the Christian church. And they believe, the Puritans believed that there would be no reestablishment at this time, when there was a national conversion of Jews, of any of the Jewish ceremonies, such as the Passover or burnt offerings. The Puritans did not believe that the Jewish temple would ever be rebuilt. And the Puritans who believed this did not believe that the converted Jews would be given any special privileges, such as ruling the Gentile nations from Jerusalem, as later dispensationalists would believe. So, to review, many of these early 19th century premillennialists believed in a future national conversion of the Jews before the dispensationalists came on the scene. But this was not something new. It's not something they themselves originated. Now, in this modest revival of premillennialism, which occurred in the early 19th century, there was one man who more than any other served as an early catalyst for this new movement. And that man's name was Edward Irving. Now, Edward Irving was born in Scotland in 1792. He was an ordained minister in the Church of Scotland in 1815. In 1822, a Church of Scotland congregation in London called Irving as their pastor, and he became an overnight sensation among London society. Before Irving had accepted this call in London, this congregation had dwindled down to about 50 people. There was little hope for its future. And that all changed soon after Edward Irving began his ministry there in London. Many came to view him as the greatest orator of that day. The sanctuary where he preached, the Caledonian Chapel, you may know Caledonia is an early Latin word for Scotland.
the Caledonian Chapel. It was designed for 500, but about 6 months into Irvin's new ministry there, two and three times that number would try to attend every Sunday. And in 1827, this congregation moved into a new building called the National Scottish Church, a building which seated 1,800 people. And in the early years, an unusual proportion of those attending these services were professional people, including members of the literary elite in London and members of Parliament. Well, then in 1824, Irving began devoting his ministry more and more to the interpretation of prophecy. And he had come under the influence of James Hatley Freer, F-R-E-R-E, a layman student of prophecy who had premillennial convictions. Now, he was a historicist, not a futurist. He was a historicist. He believed that most biblical prophecy had already been fulfilled, and he believed that this Freer believed that the world was about to enter a time of the greatest suffering, a tribulation, and that Christ would return within the next few years. Well, in 1825, Henry Drummond, who was a member of Parliament, asked Irving to speak at that year's rally for the Continental Society, a missionary organization working in Europe. Now, in his address, Irving informed the gathering, this is not what these people are expecting to hear, it's not what they wanted to hear. He informed this gathering that their missionary work had no hope of success because God's cataclysmic judgment was about to fall upon all Christendom, and especially upon that part of the world which was the old Roman Empire. And Irving thought that the coming of Christ, which would follow this judgment, was very, very near. And this meant that there was simply no time for long-term mission efforts to come to any fruition. And of course, you know, that's in great contrast to William Carey and his postmillennial sermon and convictions that started the modern missionary movement. Now, after Irving began his new emphasis on prophecy and his preaching, these professional and literary people stopped attending his Sunday services. But overall, attendance wasn't affected because other less prominent people were attracted to this new prophetic preaching, and they began attending. Now, the next major thing was Irving's translation of a book. Although Irving had only begun learning Spanish a few months earlier, he spent the whole summer of 1826 on leave from his preaching duties so he could translate into English a two-volume Spanish work on prophecy by the Chilean Jesuit Manuel Lacunza. And this impressive feat was a measure of Irving's interest in prophecy. And though he probably didn't agree with everything in this book, he appreciated its argumentation for premillennialism and its emphasis on the nearness of Christ's return. And he sent his translation to the printers in January 1827. Its publication immediately stirred up widespread interest. But what was most significant was not the translation, but the 203-page preface in which Irving explained his own ideas on prophecy. And in this preface, he stated that when he began preaching his new views on unfulfilled prophecy, his premillennialism, he, quote, did not know of one brother in the ministry who held with him in these matters, unquote. And he said he was, quote, resolved, though alone and single-handed, to maintain, unquote, his new convictions, quote, against all who should undertake to uphold the commonly received notion that the present Gentile dispensation was about to burst forth with great fruitfulness and fill the whole earth with millennial blessedness. In other words, he's contrasting his kind of rare premillennialism, rare at that time, with the predominant postmillennialism in that society. And Irving explained in his preface that he was expecting not only a judgment upon Christendom, but he was also expecting a latter rain outpouring of the Holy Spirit upon Jews and Gentiles to bring in the days of refreshing. Now, he's also a forerunner of the charismatic movement. This expectation of a coming special outpouring of the Spirit as a prophesied latter rain, it would prove very significant in Irving's later life and career. Now, before we consider more about Irving's views on the end-time work of the Holy Spirit, we need to first examine another significant development which occurred a couple of years after Irving began his new emphasis on prophecy back in 1824. Now, Henry Drummond, we've already mentioned him, he was a wealthy banker and a member of Parliament, and he responded to Irving's preaching on prophecy by sponsoring prophetic conferences at his Albury Park estates. These were located about 30 miles south of London.